and would be very conversational, as if it were intended to be read to an audience who was only going to hear it once. That's in his quote. Attacking the kind of translation that would result from Bly's approach, Eshelman argued, it is in effect a translation to entertain. This is Eshelman speaking. It utterly lacks the elliptical backlash of poetry. Images, constructs are sanded off. There's a loss of sharpness of detail, of precision of language. And then he goes on. I find this very amusing, because Eshelman says, basically, he wants, you've got to make the reader realise how hard, bloody hard it is being a translator. How hard we sweat. Blood and guts, basically, because he said there's something right about keeping the reader aware that with every line he's reading a translation, not an original poem. For translation is slavery, said Eshelman. Every translation of a poem ever done is the grief of the Tower of Babel. Translation of language is a yearning for something to happen in the psyche of man and woman that language itself is but symbolic of. Well, that's Clayton Eshelman for you. That's his view, and he's entitled to it. Yes, it is hard work, but the idea that our job is to make the reader realise it's hard work, no, I don't think that's what we should be doing. Agreeing with the most common argument against Bly's translation of Neruda, Eshelman complained that Bly was the one really being presented, or better, presenting himself. And he concluded, it is true that in the Bly and Company versions, there is no translator personality. There is no translator personality getting in the way of what one thinks the poem is, as there is in Ben Bennett's versions of Neruda, in which one again encounters Bennett's own rhetorically constricted syntax. There is something at work behind Bly's translating that is more important to him than any foreign language or poet. This something is, this is still Clayton Eshelman speaking, this is in fact that there's nothing of value in 20th century North American poetry. Therefore, Bly will translate Neruda to teach us what a real poem is and to whom we should bow. Bly's translations are versions of his doctrine. I think this gives a flavour of what Eshelman is like, but again, it's his view. Eshelman said he had more respect for Bellett's approach to Neruda because Bellett insisted on translating with personality and shaping Neruda to a specific image. Now, many critics have attacked Bellett's Neruda on the grounds that it's not translation at all, but rather imitation. Michael Wood has claimed, Bellett makes Neruda sound like Bellett, a man lost in a maze of affected diction and syntax. Now, Bellett himself has said that the stresses in his quotes at times forced him further from the originals than he wanted to go, and sometimes his English was an effort to straighten out the syntactical disorders of Neruda's poetic design. In fact, over the years, Bellett has continued to defend his approach to translation as, in quotes, an act of the imagination forced upon one by the impossibility of the utteralist transference or coincidence of two languages, two minds, and two identities, and by the autonomy of the poetic process. And by utteralist, Bellett means the sense of the world as inert substance used by plants and creatures and exploited by human beings as a source of resources. Bellett believes translating the poems of residents... Bellett believes that the utteralist approach is by nature inappropriate for translating Neruda effectively, especially for translating the poems of residents on Earth. Most of residents on Earth, Bellett argues, demands another, more creative approach. He says, literal translation is especially ill at ease with a poetry where the pressures of language are multiple, disruptive, suspended. It does not cling naturally to the contours with which the syntax and velocities of the original invested its intentions. And this is particularly true of the Residencias, he said, where the thrust is not merely open, as the mode of Whitman may be said to be open. It yawns in all directions with craters and cicatrices. Splinters like shrapnel, makes a fine art of its vertigo. It compels risk, curiosity, impurity, poetry, said Ben Bellett. And this is why Ben Bellett, and many other poets, to be fair, criticised the utteralist approach used by Donald Walsh in his 1973 edition, Residents on Earth. Bellett accused Walsh of neither presenting the voice of Neruda nor the voice of Walsh. Rather, he saw Walsh's work as literalism at its most supine and myopic, reaping the wages of anonymity, a translator's option of poverty, chastity, and obedience, transposed into a crucifixion of self-abnegation. I don't think he liked Walsh very much. Of course, Walsh strongly agreed with this version. of the situation, and he hit back. He defended his own approach to translating what he considered Neruda's simple, earthy language. Like the early translators of Neruda, Walsh was primarily interested in translation as a means to providing knowledge of the original Spanish. He came to translation as a professor of Romance languages, not as a poet. Bennett is a poet, primarily as a poet. Not, in some people would argue, a translator at all. Walsh believed it was presumptuous for a translator to replace the author's imagery with his own, as Bellett and some others did, and he believed that most of Neruda's translators, especially Bellett, stood between Neruda and his audience. Very important preposition, that. Without allowing him to speak directly. I think there's a lot in that. Bellett, by using that, remember the clinkers and causes? That's getting in the way of the poem. Because we suddenly jolted, we think, what does that mean? And we're not really responding to the original poem at all, because we've moved so far away from it. So Donald Walsh wrote the following. He was capable of hitting back, defending himself against Bellett and anybody. "The translator's double responsibility," said Walsh, "is surely to find out what the author says and to express this in the translator's language with the greatest possible fidelity to the author's concept and his expression of it." And he went on to say that Ben Bellett failed to fulfil either of these responsibilities. "Bellett's translations often betray an ignorance or misinterpretation of what Neruda says. And even when he translates, understands the Spanish, he does not give a direct translation. He has a compulsion to express himself as well as or instead of Neruda. He decorates Neruda, and Neruda does not decorate successfully," said Donald Walsh. Walsh claimed that weaknesses in Bellett's knowledge of Spanish led him to produce translations wide of Neruda's mark, and he found an unwillingness to let the poet speak for himself present on almost every page. Walsh preferred the impersonal mode of translation, steering the middle course between metaphase, a literal translation, whereas Bellett was moved to range between paraphrase and imitation. In fact, in an essay entitled "Some Thoughts on Translation," Walsh elaborated on his approach to translating Neruda. He said, "The translation who consciously departs from the text is reprehensible. But even more reprehensible is a translator who cannot read the text." He continued, "The translator should have mastered not only the language of his author, he should have mastered his own language, and this means far more than just being a native speaker of it. He should not attempt to translate an author unless he feels a genuine sympathy for his work, and unless his finesse and security in his own language approach the finesse and security of the author he's translating." And he criticised those translators who weakened or muddled or misinterpreted the boldness of Neruda's imagery and adorned his monolithic simplicity and earthiness with flights of their own fantasy. I think Walsh is wrong there as well, talking about simplicity of Neruda's poetry, because Residence on Earth is one of the most obscure books, if anyone's read it, obscure hermetic books of poetry of the 20th century in lots of ways. It's beautifully rich. It makes for a fascinating, very difficult book to read in the original Spanish and the only translation. It's certainly not simple. It's earthy, but it's certainly not simple. Donald Walsh and Robert Bly came to blows, as I said, in 1973 within the pages of a journal called the American Poetry Review. Bly condemned Walsh's new translation of Residence on Earth, calling it pale, bland, without temperament, without a trace of Neruda's anguished tone, monotonous vanilla mush. They're charming, these translators, aren't they? As if written by a comfortable Englishman. Bly claimed Walsh had failed to notice a particular mood of despair, desolation and alienation running through Residence on Earth. Now there, Bly definitely had a point, because Neruda himself turned against the book. His book, saying that Residence on Earth was a book that made you want to die, not want to live. And actually he had a very specific reason for saying that later on, because a student was found dead under a tree in Santiago, the Chilean capital, having shot himself. And the book lying beside him was Residence on Earth, open to the poem Un Día Sobre Sale. So Neruda, well before that happened, Neruda felt, this is not the kind of poetry I should be wanting. Because Neruda's poetry changed in Spain with the Spanish Civil War, and especially the murder of Lorca. His enormous friend. He was very close friends with Lorca. Not everybody knows that. I've written a play about their friendship. And Neruda, when Lorca was murdered in August 1936 by the fascists, Neruda decided his poetry had to change from inward-looking, anguished, negating, life-negating poetry to outward-looking poetry as a social or political weapon. That's what happened after Spain. And he turned his back on this book, that The Residents on Earth. So Bligh was right that there's a mood of despair in it. So to endorse his criticism of Walsh's translation of Neruda's poetry, he cited an example of a poem from Residents on Earth called Melancholia. The end of Melancholia en las Familias, Melancholy in the Families. Here are the original Spanish final lines of the poem. Pero por sobre todo hay un terrible comedor abandonado, con las alcuzas rotas y el vinagre corriendo debajo de las sillas, un rayo detenido, la luna, algo oscuro, y me busco una comparación dentro de mí. Tal vez es una tienda rodeada por el mar y paños rotos goteando salmuera. Es solo un comedor abandonado. Y alrededor hay extensiones, fábricas sumergidas, maderas que solo yo conozco, porque estoy triste y viajo, y conozco la tierra y estoy triste. Now, Walsh's offending translation in Bligh's eyes went like this, 1973. But on top of everything, there's a terrible abandoned dining room with broken jugs and vinegar flowing under the chairs, and rather dark lightning bolts stopped from the moon, and I look for a comparison within myself. Perhaps it's a tent surrounded by the sea and torn cloths oozing brine. It is only an abandoned dining room, and around it there are expanses, submerged factories, boards that only I know, because I'm sad and old and I know the earth, and I'm sad. Now, Bligh went in for the kill, basically. He pointed out a major error. Anyone seen it in the Spanish? Here's the Spanish. Now, see that line there? The penultimate line? Porque estoy triste y viajo. No? Notice the mistake? Yeah. Viejo does not mean old. What's the Spanish for old? Viejo. Exactly. So, how did old get in there, said Bligh. You know? Walsh, Bligh argued, must have misread viejo instead of the correct viejo. More importantly, Bligh added, Walsh had failed to notice the mood of the poem, or even to notice it was written by a young man, not an old one, and Pablo Neruda was still in his 20s, and proud of his energy and youth, said Bligh, and unlikely to refer to himself as old. Walsh responded very fulsomely to this charge by saying, I ask in turn how anyone who's read, much less translated this poem, could speak of it as an example of Neruda's pride in his youth. The poetry of Residents on Earth is so melancholy, he wrote, so prematurely old, so suicidal, that the author at one time seriously considered denouncing and renouncing the whole work and withdrawing it from circulation. Actually, more than that, he did consider it. He did consider. And Donald Walsh actually thought Viejo was a misprint for Viejo, which made more sense to him. Now, I'm with Walsh on when he's talking about the general overall mood of despair in Residents on Earth, and we know that from what Neruda himself said about it. But I can't agree with the idea of a misprint. Anyone who's seen the definitive authoritative edition of Neruda, the 5-volume complete works edited by Hernán Loyola, the great Neruda scholar, that's the one to go with, because he's checked all the manuscript. He knows what's the correct, and he's got viejo, travel, I travel. Not viejo in that. So Walsh was wrong there to claim it was a misprint. The spat between the two translators continued rather amusingly, if you're watching from outside, amusingly, with Walsh declaring, some of Mr. Bligh's unfortunate translations come from his ignorance of Spanish. Others reveal that he has a tin ear, a sad defect in a poet. Great stuff. I wouldn't mind a boxing match between them. This is how Robert Bligh, together with James Wright, translated the same lines from Melancholy in the Families in 1971. And 1971, by the way, that was the year that Neruda was awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature. Above all, there's a terrifying deserted dining room with its broken olive oil cruets and vinegar running under its chairs, one ray of moonlight tied down, something dark. And I look for comparison inside myself. Perhaps it's a grocery store surrounded by the sea and torn clothing from which seawater is dripping. It's only a deserted dining room, and around it there are expanses. Sunken factories, pieces of timber, which I alone know because I am sad and because I travel. And I know the earth. I'm sad. Now, those critics preferring Bly's translations of Residents on Earth poems tended to respond unfavourably to Walsh's translations, as you might imagine, and vice versa. Michael Wood, for one, maintained that only Bly made Neruda sound in English as if he might be a good poet in Spanish, because Walsh was not trying to translate Neruda, merely to provide us with the literal versions. For Wood, Walsh's approach yielded a translation that was honest, dull, stilted, usually accurate, the right sort of rendering for people really reading the Spanish with little help from across the page. However, to give an alternate opinion, Florence Udin said that Walsh's translation of Residents on Earth gave the English language audience the unique experience of a writer equally gifted in the language of English poetry and in Neruda's inspired Spanish. She argued that Walsh produced a brilliant text, stunning in its harmony with the Spanish original. Residents on Earth demonstrated Walsh's talent to recreate and project Neruda's unique voice. His English revealed that gift for word and rhythm which comes from the best poets. Another critic, Walter Snow, said, Walsh is by far Neruda's best American interpreter. He recognises the special problem in translating from a Romance language like Spanish into a Germanic tongue like English. Most of his predecessors do not appreciate Neruda's fondness for alliteration, his repetition of V sounds, the lovely S's and double L's. For Snow, Walsh succeeded in capturing Neruda's melody with renderings such as the great, great albatross died that day and wavering waters. Now, Ben Bellett has since said he was delighted to see other translators, except for Donald Walsh, of course, I presume, attempting to turn Neruda into English. Bellett said, it's what I'd hoped for. Many sounds, many orientations, intonations, many biases, though not their accompanying mafia vendettas, he said. Many permutations of pleasure, a whole orchestra tuning up on processes and procedures. But he added, recent translations have all been on the side of a puristic levelling of Neruda to the lowest case of the literal world, literal word. Neruda is sacrosanct to his American idolaters. I prefer the choral rendering of Neruda because tolerance and abundance are better than authorised or monogamous translation. I deplore all fixed points and terminal goals of translation. That was Bellett. Sounding misleadingly generous, I would say, in some ways, uncharacteristically generous. I think possibly I'm being too unfair to Bellett because he has done some wonderful versions. But I have to say that his translation can be extremely, in my view, this is only my view, can be extremely questionable. Here's some examples. The poem Arte Poetica, Ars Poetica, from Residents on Earth, begins in the original Spanish. Entre sombra y espacio, entre sombra y espacio, entre guarniciones y doncella, dotado de corazón singular y sueños funestos, precipitadamente pálido, marchito en la frente, y con luto de viudo furioso por cada día de viuda. Here's Ben Bellett's translation. Between dark and the void, between virgins and garrisons, with my singular heart and my mournful conceits, for my portion, my forehead despoiled, overtaken by pallors, a grief-maddened widow bereft of a lifetime. Right, I'm going to take, as politely as possible, I'm going to take each line one at a time. In line one, actually I like garrisons. For guarniciones, because it, for once he's used an English word which has the same rhythm and the sound as the original Spanish. But then why does he ruin it by turning the order around? The original order says guarniciones y doncella. He turns it around. So why do that? Why bother? Why not just keep it as garrisons and virgins? Seems like pure unnecessary whimsy to me. Line two. He uses conceits instead of the original, which is sueños. Sueños just means dreams. What's wrong with using dreams? He's loading it with a meaning that's not there. There's nothing wrong with dreams It's a lovely word. I don't know why he chose. You'd have to ask him. Right. My forehead despoiled. The original Spanish, to remind you, marchito. Marchito means wizened, shriveled, withered. We saw Neruda using the same word in walking around, you remember. Despoiled doesn't mean anything to do with it. It means dispossessed. It means plundered. It has a completely different connotation. It's setting up completely different notions in the reader's mind. Now, okay, if you want to call it a version of the poem, yeah, but even so, why bother? You might as well write a new poem and not call it Neruda. Call it Bellet, you know. So, and what about the word pallors? I've never seen that word in the plural in English. Has anyone ever seen pallors? Okay, it's interesting to make a jolt. But if you're going to jolt the reader, it's got to be for a reason. Why jolt the reader when the original poet didn't want to jolt the reader? The original just has, well, he actually uses an adjective in the original, it's pálido. So, it's strange. It's at an archaic, artificial and shocking value that doesn't have. Now, the worst, did anyone spot the worst mistake of the lot? Okay, any Spanish speakers amongst you, the fourth line? Right, there's the fourth line. Read it carefully. Con luto de viudo furioso por cada día de vida. Any Spanish speakers amongst you? Really terrible mistake. Anyone's? What? Yeah, he's changed the sex of viudo. Viudo means widower. He's translated that as widow. He's actually changed the whole gender of a lion to widow. He says widow. It's a widower. I mean, that's a huge mistake. It's a huge mistake. And so you've got to bear that in mind when I'm criticising Bellet here. And remember when Bellet was attacking other poets for being too literal? Okay, you can, all right, if you want to move away, at least get the sex of the person you're talking about in a line right. Here's Donald Walsh's translation, the same four lines. Between shadow and space, trimmings and damsels, endowed with a singular heart and sorrowful dreams, precipitously pallid, withered in the brow, and with a furious widower's mourning each day of life. It's more literal. Not an imaginative. You could say not an imaginative of Bellet. I would say it isn't as imaginative. At least he gets the sex of the right in the last line. Interesting choice of trimmings there. That's a really interesting choice. The Spanish original is guarniciones. Guarnición has two meanings in Spanish. It means garrison. Or it also means trimmings as in adornment or garnish. Completely different meaning. So Walsh took the second meaning. He took the garnish. Now, I prefer garrison. I prefer Bellet in this case. I prefer garrison. But if you're going to choose the alternative sense of the word, why he could have, I would suggest he could have used the word garnish, which at least captures the GA of the original. It captures the sound, the hard G, and the A of the original Spanish, if he's going to do that. So that's what I mean by a failure to accept, to respect the music of the original, of Neruda's poetry. As I say, but at least I say he's got the right sex in the last line there. There are some other examples of Belletisms. I hope I'm not being too unfair to Bellet, because he is worth reading, even if just to be get yourself worked up sometime. In Ritual de mis Piernas, The Ritual of My Legs, the poem I mentioned earlier, he translates mis largas piernas as my big legs. Larga does not mean big. Spanish larga is long. And Neruda is talking about his long legs as if they're extending away from him. The poem is about how alien they feel to him. It's not that they're big so much, that they're long, they're stretching away. Now, Bellet, I'm going to talk about one of Neruda's greatest poems now, called Explico Algunas Cosas. Let me explain a few things. This is the poem from España en el Corazón, Spain in My Heart, published in 1937, where Neruda explained to the reader for the first time how his poetry has moved from that anguished early poetry to, after Neruda's murder, after Lorca's murder, to outward-looking poetry. And he tackles it. Bellet tackles it bravely enough. And the poem begins memorably in Spanish. Preguntaréis, ¿y dónde están las lilas y la metafísica cubierta de amapolas? Y la lluvia que a menudo golpeaba sus palabras, llenándolas de agujeros y pájaros. Here's Bellett's translation. You will ask, and where are the lilacs and the metaphysics muffled in poppies and the rain which has softened battered its words till they spouted up gullies and birds? I really do not like this. I have to say, muffled is such an for me such an unpoetic word. It also sounds clumsy in English after the metaphysics. You've got the fist sound. You're setting up that kind of the plosives, the two plosives which aren't there in the original. And why gullies? Why gullies? Gullies are ditches. Agujeros in the original Spanish means holes. There are Spanish words just for ditches. You could have used Neruda could have used the word for ditch or valley. Here's my own translation. It's not perfect either. I accept that. You will ask, where are the lilacs and the metaphysics blanketed in poppies and the rain which battered his words, riddling them with holes and birds? Now, I like blanketed because, second line, because, if you look at the original, cubierta can either be an adverb, covered, or it can mean a cover or a blanket in Spanish. So I've got the two meanings in the same line, captured the same word. I did a similar thing when I translated a poem from Canto General, Neruda's 1950 book, a great epic, when he was looking back to the journeys through the forest, driven by his father, José de Carmen. Now, José de Carmen, in southern Chile, this is, José de Carmen was a very stern father who didn't want his young son, then called Neftali Reyes, before he changed his name to didn't want him to be a poet. He thought poetry was not an activity or profession for a man. And actually, he rushed up to young Neftali's room in Temuco, in southern Chile, and tossed his notebooks out of the window into the patio below. But the amazing paradox is that the dad, by driving the young Neruda through the forest of southern Chile in those early years, unwittingly fueled the boy with the love of nature, which, if anyone's read Neruda, will know that almost every poem of Neruda has some image of nature in it. Even love poems to one of his wives or his lovers, they always have nature. So Neruda was fed by his father's driving him through the forest there. So, and there's a poem in Canto General I translated. He uses the word estaciones, which could be taken as either stations or seasons. It could be either I repeated the word, but the two different meanings. It might be seen as a cop-out, but I think it works. Stations, seasons. And we'll come back to this. I used the word riddling, not sure. I got it because it gets across the force of the constant rain in Neruda's childhood town of Temuco, an idea echoed by those two plosives, blanketed and battered. To return to Bellett's translation of Let Me Explain a Few Things, Explico Algunas Cosas. Here's another stanza in the original Spanish. Mi casa era llamada... Oh, sorry, that's not... I hope you can read that. It should be black. Mi casa era llamada la casa de las flores porque por todas partes estallaban geranios. Era una bella casa con perros y chiquillos. Bellett translates that. People spoke of my house as the house of flowers. It exploded geraniums. Such a beautiful house with the dogs and the small fire. Yeah, quite. Exactly my view. I'm glad I'm not alone. I'm leaving aside the very odd line breaks. He changed the line breaks completely from the original. Why would you do that? Anyway, what on earth is that small fire doing there? For chiquillos. Chiquillos just means children. It means little boys, little children. It's a dreadful choice. So it not only changes the tone of the original... Small fire is kind of colloquial in a kind of vulgar way almost. Tone-wise, it's wrong. Also, it clashes with food imagery later on. Because the poem Neruda loved food. All his love, he loved food and drink. And a lot of his poems are about food as well. Anyone who's read his Ode to a Tomato? ode to an onion, ode to an artichoke, even an ode to my socks, by the way. Although you can't eat socks, he probably would have eaten socks if he could have done. So how a small fry sets up a false opposition with food later on. So there's hundreds of reasons why that small fry is wrong, I would say. And one final example from this poem. Here's, as I say, the exhilarating food-related stanza. Todo eran grandes voces, sal de mercaderías, aglomeraciones de pan palpitante, mercados de mi barrio de Argüelles con su estatua como un tintero pálido entre las lermuzas. El aceite llegaba a las cucharas, un profundo latido de pies y manos llenaba las calles. Metros, litros, esencia aguda de la vida, pescados hacinados con textura de techos con sol frío en el cual la flecha se fatiga. Delirante marfil fino de las patatas, tomates repetidos hasta el mal. Here's Ben Bellett's translation. All the voices were generous, the salt of the marketplace, convocations of shimmering bread, the stores of suburban Argüelles with its statue as wan as an inkwell on the sheen of a hake, oil brimmed the spoons, a wild pandemonium of fingers and feet, overflowing the streets, meters and liters, all the avid quintessence of living, fish packed in the stands, a contexture of rouge in the chill of the sun, where the arrow points faltered, potatoes inflamed and fastidious ivory, tomatoes again and again to the sea. Well, at least he got the fish right, because merluza means hake. Walsh translates it as haddock. So he gets the fish wrong. But has Bellett never been to Madrid? Because I was there quite recently. I stayed in Argüelles, right near the house that Neruda Casa de las Flores, the house where you live. It's not suburban. It's right in the heart of Madrid. Now, brim. Oil brimmed. Brimmed? Brim the spoons. Brim is not used transitively in this way, in English. You can't brim something. Something is brimming. If you look in the dictionary, it's not there. So all Bellett is doing is introducing an artificiality into the poem, which is precisely what Neruda's trying to avoid. He's trying to talk more conversationally, more colloquially to the reader, and Bellett is doing the opposite of what Neruda was trying to do. The following line, in Spanish, it's un profundo latido. He's got a wild pandemonium. Excuse me. Right. A wild pandemonium. It literally means a deep beating, as of a heart. Well, I don't know where pandemonium comes from. I would translate it perhaps as a deep throbbing, something like that. Pandemonium is just inexcusable, I think. Again, it's not what he's saying. Why do that? One more important, rather subtle point to note in that extract. See that second to last line, the penultimate line, potatoes. Now, anyone knows anything about Latin America, South American Spanish, they would not use the word patatas as Neruda does in the original. Anyone know what's Latin America? They'd use papas. They wouldn't use patata. I think this is a very deliberate attempt on Neruda's part to show his solidarity with his Iberian, the people he's been living with for 3 years, with Iberian Spanish. He's showing, with that use of the vocabulary, very subtle, that he feels more Spanish or as Spanish as Latin American. And he's seen his great Spanish friend murdered. So I think that's a very interesting use. But how do you get it across in the translation? You can't say spuds. You can't. I don't think there's a way out. I think you just have to use potatoes, because we don't have that same distinction in English. That's a problem. But it's very interesting for the Spanish speakers to spot that. Here's an example of something you just cannot. Any suggestions to the audience afterwards, gratefully accepted. Now, Neruda himself felt that his poetry suffered in English translation due to the fundamental differences between Spanish and English. And Neruda knew English well enough to translate poets such as Blake and Whitman into Spanish, and well enough to understand that the language didn't correspond to Spanish, neither in vocalization, nor in the placement, nor the color, nor the weight of the words. In an interview with Rita Gebert, a journalist, in 1970, Neruda declared, This means that the equilibrium of a Spanish poem, which may be written with verbal lavishness or economy, but has its own order and way of placing each word, can find no equivalent in English. It's not a question of interpretive equivalence, no. The sense may be correct. Indeed, the accuracy of the translation itself or the meaning may be what destroys the poem. That's why I think the Italian comes closest, he said. Because by keeping the values of the words, the sound helps reflect the sense. It seems to me that the English language, so different from Spanish and so much more direct, often expresses the meaning of my poetry but does not convey its atmosphere. That's an interesting quote. Now, I have an interesting opinion about the Italian translation. I mean, I do read Italian. It's a strange thing. If you read an Italian translation of a Neruda poem, it's so similar, it's like a carbon copy. It's almost too similar to do anything different. So it's... So here I am talking about English, having English words, English translations should be respecting the sound of the original and the rhythm. But then when you read in Italian, it's so similar, you almost wonder why do they bother? It's a very interesting thing. Shortly after Neruda's death on September 23rd, 1973, just 12 days after Pinochet's military coup, the critic and translator J.M. Cohen wrote, "Neruda's poetry is in general ill-served by its English translation. Though through no fault of the scholars who've done the translating, some of them accomplished poets in their own right. The fault lies with the demotic speech that industrial society has fostered and with the variant employed by literary men writing in English in our day. Poetry is above all the art of evoking powerful emotions through verbal music, and Neruda's exuberant Spanish has its counterpart in the English poetry of the Renaissance rather than the sober dialect of our contemporary minor poets. Major poets, or the willful stridency of some of our lesser writers. Neruda in translation tends to sound inflated and bombastic." This is J.M. Cohen writing. "Nothing could be less true of the original." Let me speak for a moment about the importance of Neruda's Chileanness, the fact that he was a Chilean poet. Chileans think of Neruda as their national legacy, which is why some of them didn't like the film we saw last night. They thought it was not reverential enough towards their great poet. Certainly not reverential at all. Larraín did not want to be reverential. It was the opposite of what he wanted to be. One construction worker in Chile said, "Neruda represents all of us, not just the worker. He represents the student, the housewife, or an executive who's drawn to poetry. He can be difficult to translate, and he often is, but the difficulty is rarely due to the presence of regional colloquialisms or highly idiomatic language. Chile has always been the most European of South American countries, and generally one finds far more colloquial language in Mexican or Cuban poets, for example. Same time, I think it's important to go to the country where the poet you're translating has lived. In the Neruda case, of course, that means Chile, although he lived in many countries, in Spain, France, Italy, Argentina, as well as a bizarre six-year Oriental experiences as a diplomat. There's a wonderful 1966 early biography of Neruda called El Viajero Inmóvil by Monegal, Rodríguez Monegal, which means the motionless traveller. It's a wonderful title because Neruda travelled all over the world, but wherever he was, he was longing to be back in Chile. It's a great title. The great translator from Chinese, Arthur Whaley, expressed no interest whatsoever in travelling to China. He felt it would destroy his sense of the country and the ancient world he'd gleaned through its poets. He didn't want to spoil the experience of his imagination, his sense of historic landscape. I've never felt those misgivings at all. I've been to Chile quite a few times. Of course, I'm Neruda's biographer, so I had to go to Chile anyway. But I would have done it. I would have done just having read his memoirs, having read his poetry, I would have wanted to go anyway just to suck in and to soak in the spirit. But I spoke to his friends, his surviving relatives. I interviewed the people he saved on the Winnipeg, the boat, 2,000 refugees he saved from Spanish fascism, and the people who harboured him in hiding in the film that we saw yesterday. I think the culture of a poet is crucial to the language he uses. Let me quote William O'Daly again in this context. O'Daly has translated, as I said, all of Neruda's 7 posthumous books of poetry. And those books Neruda was intending to leave, by the way, to posterity as a birthday present for his 70th birthday. He never made it. He died 69 in hospital. And that's why they dug him up 3 years ago to exhume his body to see whether he'd been possibly been poisoned. We don't know, as I said, but O'Daly told one interviewer, and I totally agree with this, every word he says, "I respond to the original poem, to my experience of that poem, using my senses, drawing on my imagination, my skills, and as much knowledge of the poet and his time as is available to me. That is, the body of the poet's work is personal, cultural, social, and political milieu, and the traditions on which he draws. No amount of information is too much, and any shard might inform the translation of a poem or passage. My interest," said O'Daly, "is to render the original poem as clearly as I can while coming as close as possible by staying out of the way. It's a practice not unlike Tai Chi," he said. Interesting analogy. "In the literary sense, it's a search for equivalence, close approximations, or at worst, effective substitutions from the level of diction to the imagery to the musical properties of the original. I've also thought of myself as a fellow musician," said O'Daly. That's a rather lovely thought. "One who conveys a particular recording composed by Don Pablo and on which he plays lead guitar. Does attempting to translate one cultural element to another in some way alter the meaning of the poem? It's true that poets are products of their time and culture, and as a result, their poetry will undoubtedly have an influence on their own cultural practices and experiences, which other languages may not be able to describe. Here's an intriguing example. Poem 16 from Neruda's 20 Love Poems, A Song of Despair. There's a line in Spain which reads, "La lámpara de mi alma te sonrosa los pies." Sonrosar means to turn something pink or red. But which verb to use in English? The answer lies in the fact that poem 16 is actually Neruda's paraphrase of a poem by the Bengali poet Tagore from his 1915 collection, The Gardener. The line from Tagore's poem 30, reads, "Your feet are rosy red with the glow of my heart's desire." Now, new Bengali brides colour their feet red with a dye known as alta, A-L-T-A. Of course, the concept of dyeing a woman's feet and its association with marriage is foreign to Hispanic culture and to, I think, to this culture. I'm not aware of any English brides who suddenly dye their feet red. But if you know the Indian context, a valid English translation might be, as I've done at the bottom there, "The lamplight of my soul dyes your feet pink." To get the cross-cultural reference from dye from the original Tagore inspiration for the poem. The American John Falsteiner wrote a whole book on translating Neruda's Las Alturas de Machu Picchu, The Heights of Machu Picchu. In it, Falsteiner described Neruda's sensuousness as the greatest challenge for the translator, for which he argued it may be difficult to find an equivalent in English, a language presumably lacking in such sensuality, which I would totally disagree with. "I've always found this an odd view, as if exoticizing and implicitly denigrating the world south of the border, representing it as a world of hot passion in contrast to the supposed cool rationalism of the north, civilized north." In his book, Translating Neruda, John Falsteiner appears to underplay or even altogether overlook the significance of cultural perspective as a refracting lens in translation. Of course, until the 1980s, there was indeed a tendency to view translation as if it occurred in a cultural vacuum. And the idea for Falstein's book came from a passage in George Steiner's study of language, I'm sure some of you have read, called After Babel, in which Steiner deplored the fact that whereas a good many literary creators had left documentation in the form of notes and rough drafts to show how they worked, the business of translation remains comparatively mysterious. We know next to nothing, Steiner wrote, of the genetic process which has gone into the translator's practice, of the prescriptive or purely empirical principles, devices, routines which have controlled his choice of this equivalent rather than that one, of one stylistic level in preference to another. And Falsteiner wanted to plug that, to fill that gap. However, did he succeed with his own translations, Falsteiner, of Heights of Machu Picchu? For the award-winning poet, British poet Christopher Reed, no, he didn't. Basically, John Falsteiner's efforts to be both faithful to the Spanish and true to the English idiom in Neruda's Heights of Machu Picchu end up with something that doesn't read like a poem, according to Christopher Reed. And Reed cites four lines from the beginning of Canto, the 11th canto in Heights of Machu Picchu. And by the way, notice how Neruda, stubborn poet that he was, spells Machu Picchu wrongly. He knew that there was only one C in the first Machu, but he insisted on having two. That's poets for you, you know. Here's the original. A través del confuso esplendor, a través de la noche de piedra, déjame hundir la mano y deja que me palpite como un ave mil años prisionera el viejo corazón del olvidado. This is how John Feldsteiner translates those four lines. Through the dazing splendor, through the night of stone, let me plunge my hand and let there beat in me like a bird a thousand years imprisoned the old forgotten human heart. Although it's not quite as bad as Reed makes it out, I think. I respect Reed. I know him personally quite well. He's a great poet in his own right. I think Reed's being a little bit harsh in some ways, but it's not great. It's not great. As Reed puts it, Neruda strives for something that is bardic, liturgical, incantatory. Feldsteiner, meanwhile, trots along with a rhythm of docile workaday prose. In other words, he simply failed to make a poem. I dare not suggest how he might have achieved that prodigious feat. This is Chris Reed talking. It might have been tempted to seek a poetic equivalent for Neruda's moony, stony, windy, bloody rhetoric in Pastiche, Dylan Thomas, or for his Vatic tone in Ginsberg's spaced out measures. But both of these devices would have risked who knows what comic effects. Something new, something that could not be prescribed was called for. What a pity we do not find it here. Oh dear. Oh dear. Ouch. Ouch. Coming back to the issue of musicality of Neruda's poetry, I have to point out a curious fact. Neruda, and I mentioned it last night to people in the audience in my Q&A, he had no ear for music, for classical music. I mean, he fell asleep during Glyndebourne when he was taken by a friend of mine to an opera and was snored so loud he had to be turfed out of the auditorium, thrown out of the auditorium in the second half. One of his friends, who was one of those who hid him in hiding in the period we saw in the film last night, Aida Figueroa, who with her husband, Sergio Insunza, was one of those who harboured Neruda, told me in Santiago. When he was very ill, Pablo told me at Isla Negra, Aida, how much it would have helped me to be able to listen to music. Pablo was a very charming man. He valued the person he was talking to. I never heard him talk ill of anyone. He was a genius, not only as a poet, but in everything relating to human relationships. The only thing he didn't have was an ear for music. He couldn't understand music. He could hear the sounds of birds, people's words, but not music. It's a very curious thing. I've actually met quite a few poets who don't really respond to classical music in the same way. I've actually talked to Fiona Sampson, who's here. I know she's here this week because she lives nearby, and she's at Roehampton, near where I live in Wimbledon. And she was also a former violinist, and a very good violinist, so an example of a musician who became a poet. So she's not, but she's written about the relationship or the distance between the two forms of music. By the way, if anyone's interested, I know the name of that opera that Neruda fell asleep in. It's Cimarosa's Il Matrimonio Segreto, The Secret. So if anyone wants to fall asleep in an opera, go to that one. But all Neruda's poetry sings, or most of it does. Even the simple delightful odes to tomato, to the artichoke, to his socks. They make the ordinary extraordinary and the extraordinary ordinary, like his great friend Picasso did with his painting. And often those odes contain very short lines, sometimes just one word. Or, in the case of one of the odes, one letter, E, Y, meaning and. As William O'Daly has pointed out, Neruda builds up an interesting tension between the brevity of the lines, and the sounds they modulate or harness. When one translates the odes into English, said O'Daly, the equivalents are often only a single syllable, maybe two. So an inevitable oversimplification occurs, and the loss of music is more profound than usual. One of the poems in the wonderful posthumous collection, one of the seven books of poems that Neruda wanted to leave, that I highly recommend them. Seven books of poems he left We wanted to leave, and they were published in 1974 by Losada in Buenos Aires. Obviously, it couldn't be published in Chile because it was under coup, military coup. It's called El Mar y las Campanas, The Sea and the Bells. It begins... Esta campana rota quiere sin embargo cantar. And O'Daly captures it successfully, I think, as this broken bell still wants to sing, echoing the sound of a bell tolling the original. But it's not always possible to achieve that success. In any case, as O'Daly has also noted, the silences are just as important as the sounds that a poem makes. As he puts it, a translator needs to get closer than capturing some essence of the original meaning, or he's composing something like a version, a la Stephen Berg's expressly labelled versions of Anna Akhmatova. And yes, it's necessary to create, this is still O'Daly's writing, yes, it's necessary to create a sense of flow in the target language that approximates the flow of the original, and that is poetry. If one doesn't compose a viable poem in the target language, while recreating as closely as possible the experience of the original, of which denotative and connotative meanings are a major part, what has he brought across? The words, punctuation, line breaks. Computers can do that for us, he said, with the added advantage of occasionally hilarious results. Anyone who's used Google to translate a poem will know what I mean. Now let's turn to the very latest book of English translations from Neruda out on the market. And we're very lucky enough to have Neil Astley here, who's published the book with Blood Axe. It's a wonderful edition with beautiful facsimiles of some of Neruda's original green handwriting. He always wrote in green ink. These are the 21 poems that were discovered recently in the headquarters of the Neruda Foundation in San Diego, La Chascona, which was used to be one of Neruda's three houses. Like any good poet, like any good communist poet, Neruda had three houses. And he discovered him in these poems in various drawers and boxes at the headquarters, as I say, of the Foundation Santiago in 2011. It was published first as Tu pies toco en la sombra y otros poemas inéditos, and then earlier this year as Then Come Back, the Lost Neruda Poems. Now, I believe, as Neruda's biographer, that it's crucial to acknowledge the context in the poet's life, especially with a poet like Neruda, where the life and the work, the poems, are so intimately interwoven, interconnected. These newly discovered poems were variously scrawled on the back of a menu, the reverse of a music program. I bet he hated the music. That's one of those concerts he fell asleep in, probably. He often wrote poems on ships, on airplanes, so one of these poems is written on an Italian transatlantic liner, on napkins, on other scraps of paper. A date from the 1950s, the mid-1950s, oh, sorry, the beginning of the 1950s, actually, to only months before Neruda's death in 1973. They're all incomplete, by definition. He hadn't put them out for publication, so presumably, by definition, he wasn't ready for them to be published. Some even end in commas. But many of them are an absolute delight. I highly recommend the book. It's a fantastic book. Translated by Forrest Gander, a great American translator of poetry, a great poet in his own right. Done a great job. They're fizzing, the poems are fizzing with Neruda's passion for life, which is the subtitle of my book, a kind of joy of life, effervescent joy of life. And for that alone, for that infectious joy of life, they're worth reading, because they come through beautifully. There are times where I think Neruda, if he'd had time to look at them again, he would have improved the Spanish, the original, because some of it's clumsy, not the English, but the original Spanish. For instance, there's a phrase he uses, quanto canto. I don't think he would have thought that sounds too clumsy, too clunky. Those two so similar words next to each other. Or another similar one, that's poem two. Or territorio terrible. Those two words ending in ter, I think he would have taken one of those out, struck one of those out. But that's nothing to do with translation, that's just something I spotted in the original Spanish. One of my favourite poems in the book is this one about a telephone, about the despotic nature of the telephone. It's kind of like one of his odes to ordinary objects, although it's written much later than the odes. The odes were written in the mid-1950s. He wrote it in 1973. Annie bridles in a glorious outburst of humorous agitation at the despotism of the telephone, degrading myself to the point of yielding my superior ear, which I consecrated innocently to birds and music, to this everyday prostitution, affixing my ear to an enemy trying to take control of my being. It's brilliant. It's a brilliant, great fun. It reminds me, as I say, of the old. It also reminds me, strangely enough, of Walking Around, that weird poem from the 1934, which, if you read the whole of it, is a lot about the burdens of bureaucracy. There are echoes that no one else has pointed out in the reviews of the book in English about that. That was written much longer ago, 1934. And also traces of one of my favourite of all Neruda's books, 1958 book, Istavagario, which has been translated by Alistair Reid. Self-mocking, beautiful puncturing in his own pomposity. I love that book. Very self-mocking irony. And a poem in there called Poor Fellows, where he gently protests about intrusions from prying eyes, which has something of the same of this as this telephone. So it is, I say, impossible to disentangle Neruda's life from his work, and so I'm so glad that in Then Come Back, there's wonderful notes at the back by the Neruda Foundation's librarian, Daddy Orsis, about when the poems were written. It makes a huge difference to understanding the context. Forrest Gander's translations are generally absolutely excellent. I've got no problem. They're really wonderful. I highly recommend them. Just very occasionally, I found moments which jarred. So he elects to translate battaglia as struggle in poem two. I much prefer battle. The reason is this. Neruda often employed a military lexicon in his love poems to his third wife, Matilde Urrutia. Most evidently in the captain's verses, La Bestia del Capitan, which is a book he wrote anonymously when he was on Capri with Matilde, and that's formed the basis of Michael Radford's wonderful film, 1994 film, Il Postino, published anonymously in 1952 in Naples. So by now, when he was writing Captain's Verses, he was a member of the Chilean Communist Party. He saw no clear dividing line between his political and his love poetry at all. In poem 7, Gander translates La Fecunda Frescura as that tannic tang. Now, I entirely understand Gander's attempt to retain the alliteration of the original Spanish. For me, however, the English version deviates too dramatically from both the meaning and the tone of the Spanish. Literal translation of La Fecunda Frescura is the fruitful freshness, which I am not advocating in any way as a translation. That doesn't work either. But tannic suggests a bitterness which is absent from the original Spanish. So I'm not sure. That's a very hard phrase, La Fecunda Frescura, to translate. But as I say, these are minor quibbles, totally minor quibbles. Gander versions are wonderful. They capture the spirit, the sound, the music, and Neruda's playful enjoyment of the world around him. I highly recommend the Blood Export, not just because Neil's in the audience. I would have said that if he, and I didn't know he would be in the audience, I would have said that anyway. Recommended. Extremely fine collection. For finally, I know we're running out of time. Let's look at one of Pablo Neruda's most famous poems, poem 15 from his 20 love poems, A Song of Despair. September the 23rd, to mark the 40th anniversary of Neruda's death, BBC World Service paid tribute to him through a video of poem 15 recited in 21 of the 28 languages operated by the BBC World Service. Now, don't panic. I'm not going to run through all 21 versions in 5 minutes. I'd like to compare three English translations of poem 15 with my own new one. The thing to remember is they were written in 1924. Neruda was going through a period of, I would call, protracted post-adolescence, searching for his identity, searching for a poetic voice, also a human voice, searching for fulfilling love. He had a lot of sexual partners, sexual relationships as a student, and then as a poet in the 1920s. early to mid-1920s before he zoomed off to bizarre first posting in Burma, Rangoon in 1927. He had lots of relationships, but none of them were fulfilled. If you read the 20 love poems, none of them you sense a really fulfilling love affair. His first fulfilling love affair was probably with this mysterious woman he met in Burma, called Josie Bliss. We don't know what her real name was. He called her his Burmese panther and his love terrorist, because she was so jealous that he had to sleep with a knife under his pillow. And there's a wonderful poem about that he wrote in, called El Tango del Viudo, The Widower's Tango, which you must read. And I've got it here, which is about how he never forgot Josie Bliss, even though he abandoned her because of her sheer jealousy. He thought she was going to kill him. Literally, he left her. Later on, he went back in the 1950s with Matilde, his third wife, trying to find any traces of her, and couldn't find her. He never forgot her. So the point is that when you translate the love poems, you've got to capture Neruda's confusion, sense of confusion, his sense of incoherence, inarticulacy. You mustn't lose that, because it was deliberate. He was expressing his own spirit. At the same time, the poems must sing, because all great poems sing, in my view. A poem doesn't have music to it, it's not a great poem. Maybe I'm being a little bit too dogmatic, but I think pretty much I would stick by that. Now here's the original poem 15. Hope it's big enough. Sorry, to get it all on one page, it's got to be quite small. Me gustas cuando callas, porque estás como ausente. Y me oyes desde lejos y mi voz no te toca. Parece que los ojos se te hubieran volado y parece que un beso te cerrara la boca. Como todas las cosas están llenas de mi alma, emerges de las cosas, llena de alma mía. Mariposa de sueño, te pareces de mi alma, te pareces de la palabra melancolía. Me gustas cuando callas y estás como distante. Y estás como quejándote, mariposa, en arrullo, y me oyes desde lejos, mi voz no te alcanza. Déjame que me calle con el silencio tuyo. Déjame que te hable también con tu silencio. Claro como una lámpara, simple como un anillo. Simple como un anillo. Eres como una noche callada y constelada. Tu silencio es de estrella, tan lejano y sencillo. Me gustas cuando callas, porque estás como ausente, distante y dolorosa, como si hubieras muerto. Una palabra entonces, una sonrisa bastan, y estoy alegre, alegre de que no sea cierto. Anyone who knows the music of Victor Jara, the singer-songwriter, great singer-songwriter who was murdered by Pinochet's thugs in 1973, he turned that into a beautiful version. A poem, you can find it online. Also Ángel Parra, the son of Violeta Parra, also did a version as well. Both of them are wonderful. Here's W.S. Merwin's translation. This is the one that people, back from the 60s, people do still turn to this. But, the very first line, doesn't sound like English to me. But W.S. Merwin is still alive. He's a great poet. I respect a lot of what he does, but I don't like that first line. I like for you to be still. It is as though you were absent, and you hear me from afar, and my voice does not touch you. It seems as though your eyes had flown away, and it seems as though a kiss had sealed your mouth. As all things are filled with my soul, you emerge from the things filled with my soul. You are like my soul, a butterfly of dream, and you are like the word melancholy. I like for you to be still, and you seem far away. It sounds as though you were lamenting, a butterfly cooing like a dove. And you hear me from far away, and my voice does not reach you. Let me come to be still in your distance, and let me talk to you with your silence that is bright as a lamp, simple as a ring. You are like the night with its stillness and constellation. Your silence is that of a star, as remote and candid. I like for you to be still, as though you were absent, distant and full of sorrow, as though you had died. One word then, one smile is enough. I'm happy, happy that it's not true. One more version, Terence Clark. It pleases me when you grow silent, as though you were absent, and you hear me from afar. My voice does not touch you. It seems your eyes have flown from you, and it seems that a kiss has closed your mouth. As everything is filled with my soul, you emerge from everything filled with that soul. Dream butterfly, you resemble my soul and you resemble the word melancholy. It pleases me when you grow silent and are far away, as if moaning, butterfly lulled to sleep, and you hear me from afar and my voice does not arrive. Let me quiet myself with your silence. Let me speak with you also with your silence. Clear as a lamplight, simple as a ring. You're like the night, quieted and clustered with stars. Your silence is of the star, so far away and simple. It pleases me when you grow silent as though you were absent, distant and dolorous as though you were dead. One word then, one smile is enough, and I'm happy, happy that that is not so. Well, it's getting closer in some ways. Not sure about the distant and dolorous as though you were dead. Don't like those three D's. Don't like those three D's at all. Again, this is my version. You're perfectly entitled not to like it. This is just another version, another attempt. I love your hush, as if you were absent and heard from afar, my voice cannot touch you. It seems that your eyes have flown away and your mouth has been sealed with a kiss. All things on earth are filled with my soul, and you emerge from them filled with my soul. You're like my soul, butterfly of dreams, and you resemble the word melancholy. I love your hush as if you were distant, and you moan and coo like a lulling butterfly. Heard from afar, my voice does not touch you. Let me find my own stillness in your silence. Let me speak to you through your very silence, bright as a lamp, plain as a ring. You're like the night, a mute constellation. Your starlit lull is distant, simple. I love your lush as if you were absent. You're a distant sorrow as if you died. But one word's enough, or just a smile. And I'm happy that it was no more than a lie. Not bad, not bad. Here we go. Looking at W.S. Merwin very quickly. I'd like for you to be still. That word still is ambiguous. It applies motionless, which is not in the Kayalstia in the original Spanish. I don't like still. I think it's an ambiguous word in English. It can mean quiet, but it can also mean without moving. There are two other things I could mention, but. Anything else? Anyone else not like that? Anyone else think there are problems with that verse? I mean, does it sound like English? I like for you to be still. Sounds archaic. Doesn't sound like... I mean, okay, you could say he was, as I said, he was a teenager, post-teenager, angst, sort of awkward, clumsy. Yes, he was talking about, but I don't think it works as an English poem in a way that some of the love poems do in Merwin's voice. So... Anyway, that's only my view. So, do we finally agree with the Russian writer Vladimir Nabokov when he wrote, "What is translation?" Sorry, not finished quite yet. But he said, "What is translation? On a platter, a poet's pale and glaring head, a parrot's screech, a monkey's chatter and profanation of the dead." As you can see, Nabokov didn't think you could translate very easily. He's probably right, ultimately. And was Robert Frost right when he said poetry was what gets lost in translation? I hope not. It's true that a great poem probably allows for no rearrangement of words, let alone those in a foreign language. But we can go on trying, and trying by attempting to respect and preserve both the meaning and the music of the original. If we do that, we are getting as close as we can to the remarkable richness of Pablo Neruda's words. So thank you for your attention, and I'm happy to take questions if you've got any time at all. I know we're running. Happy to take any questions about... Yeah, if I can hear, sorry. Yeah.
The earlier...
Yeah. Yes, la tiendas means store. That's right. Tiendas de camp. That was the one in Walking Around, wasn't it? Sucede en el canso de ser hombre. I'm sure it's stores, it's shops. Why would it be? It's set in Buenos Aires. So, yeah, exactly. Tienda de campana. Tienda de campana means a tent, as you know. Whereas, yeah, exactly. That was a very strange choice. Was that in the Ben Bennett? Who translated it? As?